Hey everybody, it's Dr. Smith. Today we're going to be talking about the man, the myth, the legend, James Madison, a guy that many people regard as the greatest American political philosopher or thinker. I'm inclined to think that's probably true. Madison, let's get right into it. First off, I hope you're all well and safe before I forget, and everybody is taking care. So, all right. James Madison, born March 16th, 1751, and he died many years later, June 28th, 1836. But some other things to know. He had a life that was truly, truly impressive. For the ages of 11 to 16, he studied under a tutor away from home, a guy named Donald Robertson, who tutored a lot of like the very famous kind of well-off Southern young gentleman from kind of all over the South. Then he moved back home where Reverend Thomas Martin was his tutor at home. And then he went to college. And he went to college at not at William & Mary, like a lot of the great Virginia kind of elite thinkers went. But he went to the College of New Jersey, which is now known as Princeton, of course. And Princeton, his specializations were Hebrew and political philosophy. But it should be noted that Madison was very familiar with, he was very, very good apparently at Latin and Greek as well. So that's very interesting to me. And then we kind of get to his kind of professional accolades, right? From 1786 to 1787, he was a delegate to the Congress of the Confederation. 1787, he was a representative of Virginia at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. 1789 to 93, he was a member of the House of Representatives representing the great Commonwealth of Virginia. 1801 to 1809, he was Secretary of State under the Jefferson administration. And then 1809 to 1817, he himself was president. Of course, that was during the great conflagration known as the War of 1812 that takes place during his time. Some people regard that as the Second American Revolution. And not just for giggles. I mean, it is a point where our relationship to Britain was finally, you might argue, normalized after that. So, after he retired from the presidency, his main work seems to have been really working with Virginia education and Virginia politics in different ways. And notably, he was one of the co-founders of UVA. You know, obviously Jefferson is the dominant person in that story, but he's going to be still nonetheless involved in the founding of the University of Virginia. And he will serve as the rector of UVA from 1826 until 1836. So it's still tied up well into our glorious university, even though he's not quite as essential to its history as Mr. Jefferson. All right, now guys, Madison. Why Madison when it comes to American political philosophy and thought? Well, in many ways, the American Revolution is really a critical moment because it's where the rubber hits the road, right? We've had all these Enlightenment thinkers and Renaissance thinkers, but they're still, you know, they're still kind of working through ideas in ways that oftentimes seem either a reaction to real world events, or they're simply grounded in kind of general philosophical inquiry, which isn't to denigrate them by any means, right? Like, but what the Americans do is the Americans turn to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment thinkers, and they ask themselves, how can we be informed by these thinkers and generate, design, create a functional, practical government? In other words, how do we achieve praxis, the real unification of both the philosophy and the thought and the ethics on the one hand, and the practical realities and practice on the other? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at, first off, with Madison, you can see Madison as really critical in the constitutional process by which United States created our current Constitution and moved on from our first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, which in many ways resemble more an intergovernmental organization foundation document than a constitution in the modern sense. It's very, very archaic. It's worth looking at. I mean, it won't take you long. It's very short. And the American Constitutional Convention is a moment where a ton of really well-intentioned and very, very capable political thinkers come together and begin to debate pretty furiously how we can have a political system that both preserves individual liberty and rule of law, but also does this in a way that creates a stable, durable government. So we escape the fates of like the Greek democracies, which were often so short-lived. These are very real, practical debates. Three figures kind of stand out to me from the Constitutional Convention, not necessarily, well, in the sense that I'm thinking of, in the sense of that in their absence, it's hard to imagine the compromises that are achieved are going to happen. One is George Washington, you know, the great hero. The other is Benjamin Franklin, another great hero, though in a fundamentally different way, the oldest member of the Constitutional Convention. And then finally, little Jimmy Madison, who I think may have been the youngest representative and was really critical in helping to define how debates and arguments and discussions and coalitions develop and progress throughout the Constitutional Convention. He's just a treasure. So we're going to look at, basically we're going to talk about, pardon me, two different parts of what are called the Federalist Papers. Now, the Federalist Papers are really interesting. They are political philosophy and thought, and many, many, many people regard them as the greatest works of political philosophy in American history. Certainly, I think it's hard to argue they're anything but the most influential, if not maybe the most original, but I think you could make an argument they are the most original. The bulk of them were written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay wrote a few of them. But really the ones that stand out that we almost always go to over and over are Madison's. And the two I want to talk about today are Federalist No. 10 and Federalist No. 51. Now, had you read No. 10, I encourage you to read 51 if you have time. They're both super short, right? The reason they're short is they weren't just published as like high philosophy. They are everything I love about how political philosophy ideally is done, which is it's a discourse not just between scholars, but between scholars and ordinary, normal, non-political philosopher people who don't have the time or the inclination to dedicate their whole lives to politics. And specifically, what we see is that they are published in newspapers as a series of letters, originally anonymously, and that these newspapers, they're both, honestly, political philosophy and thought on the one hand, and they're propaganda. They're meant to encourage people to get their representatives to support the adoption of the Constitution. So it's not one or the other, it is both. And I think that's a rare and wonderful thing to see. A propaganda that's not just centered on emotional influence. So truly rare and wonderful. So let's kind of break down Federalist No. 10 first, and then we'll just hit up No. 51 a little more briefly, all right? So No. 10 is entitled The Union as a Safeguard Against Domestic Faction and Insurrection. Now, one of the things that's very, very critical, and if you've had a intro to political philosophy class that covered ancient Greece, for instance, one of the things you're well aware of is that early democracies, Greek pure democracies, true democracies, direct democracies, whatever you want to call them, that don't have a graduated representative class that is selected by some part of the people or all of the people, tend to be quite fragile. They're fragile because they fall apart under the influence of a demagogue, or they fall apart because of faction or some combination thereof. Now, we've talked about faction a little bit already, but ultimately, just to understand faction, first let me give you the definition that Mr. Madison gives us, right? So, a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens, or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. That's his definition, right? A different way to put it, though, I think it's equally, it says it amounts to the same thing as. If we think of Rousseau and how Rousseau conceptualizes the state that is just, the just political system, right? Rousseau will argue that a political system is just insofar as it serves the common good, the general will, and the general interest. When it begins to subvert the general will in the interest of particular wills or particular goods or particular interests, that is to say the interests of certain subgroups in society, even if it's the majority, but still undermines the rights and privileges and needs of any minority, well, then that is the emergence of tyranny. That is the breakdown of ethical government. So faction is anytime we get a particular will or a particular interest that either conceives of itself as in the general interest or general will, but it really isn't, or just doesn't care that it's not in the interest of the general will or the general interest. And these happen a lot, right? Now, faction is often used kind of interchangeably with a couple other terms, depending on where you look at in political philosophy. Interest groups are frequently, that term is used as synonymous, as is party, right? So basically, any kind of amalgamation of people who share similar interests or similar passions that cause them to realize that they're a group and then to seek to control the mechanisms of the government in such a way, shape, and form as to cause its output to benefit them at the expense of the general will. All right. So, this is obviously a problem. Right? This is a huge, gigantic problem because it undermines that ultimate goal of preserving liberty for certain classes of people. And when any class, any faction, any interest group in society feels their liberty is being undermined by the state, well, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to begin to interpret the state in terms that look more and more like a Hobbesian war of all. And the state is going to steadily incline towards disintegration, right? It's going to not only be unjust, but it's going to be inclined towards just simply falling apart. And this is gigantic. This is it's really interesting to me because this is like maybe the moment where it becomes systematically clear. Not clear for the first time in any sense, but systematically clear for the first time that the cause of revolution is very frequently precisely the same as tyranny. That tyranny or perceived tyranny is analogous to the principal justification for rebellion. Not just in an ideological sense, not just in an ideal sense, but in a very practical sense, a theoretical sense. Okay. So, what else does this lead us to? Well, a couple things. One is, Madison makes it clear that we can think of the causes of faction as either natural or latent, and the two are interlinked with one another. So natural are basically we have different and unequal faculties for attaining property and power, different, we're good at acquiring and working with different types of property. We have differences in terms of our natural reason and self-love, which lead to different kind of opinions and passions. So that's all very natural to us. So we are both rationally prone to faction and we are emotionally prone to faction. There is no contradiction there. The latent causes specifically hinge on two big things. One is difference of opinion, and he specifically notes difference of opinion on religion and difference of opinion on government. But the other thing is, and the thing that he emphasizes, is the unequal distribution of property. Now, again, if you've taken an introduction to political philosophy that includes the Greeks and the Romans and so forth, this is completely familiar to you. That's nothing new. So the unequal distribution of property as a cause of regime change is a very familiar, regular sort of thing. It's not unusual. It's not surprising. It's pretty much what we expect. So the latent causes combined with the natural causes are what result in the proliferation of faction, right? Now, here's the thing. For faction to grow, it needs like oxygen, right? But the oxygen for faction is specifically liberty, freedom, right? If you don't have freedom of speech, if you don't have freedom of association, if you don't have freedom of religion, freedom of occupation, freedom of vocation, freedom of to marry who you want, freedom to identify as you want, to dress like you want, to of course, the privacy that comes with freedom, one is inclined to think, is also important. If you don't have those things, then faction can't grow, right? Because faction requires people coming to an agreement about what constitutes their shared interest and their shared identity, which requires all those other freedoms. So this leads Madison to an intriguing set of assumptions. First off, there are two methods of curing faction, literally getting rid of faction, preventing faction from emerging in a political system. One of these is to destroy the liberty essential to faction. Now, he rejects this, right? Worse than the cure is worse than the disease, unquestionably. The other big cure is we give every citizen the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests. So this ultimately is going to mean that we have, in essence, a complete elimination of difference of opinion, thought, all that good stuff. And ultimately, that's not practical, and it's certainly not ethical, right? So in essence, if we take these two methods, destroying liberty and giving everyone the same opinions, these add up together to the cure for faction is totalitarianism. It is the elimination of personal freedom, the elimination of pluralism, the elimination of diversity, the elimination of being able to, literally being able to think of your interests as separate from the interests of state and society as a whole. And again, the cure is worse than the disease. Madison is both predicting the emergence of totalitarian movements in the 20th century and rejecting them as utterly grotesque, right? Okay. Then he says, if we're not going to be able to cure it, then if we can't deal with the causes, thereby curing, then we're going to have to deal with the effects of faction. And we have to therefore compensate for it rather than seek to eliminate it. How do we do this? How do we manage this? This is a real dilemma. Hypothetically, we could attempt to create a system which gave enormous power to an enlightened individual or group of individuals. Something like, again, to go back to the classics, Plato's philosopher king, or the guardian class, right? So a group of people who are kind of aloof from the rest of us, they're not therefore judging their own cases, they're chosen for their unique enlightenment, ethical and intellectual enlightenment. And Madison says this is a bad idea. And it's a bad idea because putting your trust in the abilities of enlightened leadership is putting your trust in something that's not always going to be the case. Not all leaders, no matter how you choose them, no matter what your method of selection is, are going to be enlightened and remain enlightened. And that leaves us, therefore, only with institutions, with the law, with creating a constitution, if you will, that protects us from the worst effects of factions. Now, let's clarify what an institution is. An institution is, in essence, a structure that we have formalized, we have delimited. Well, what's a structure, Dr. Smith? Okay, well, a structure is any time, if you think of structures like an architecture, right? A structure is something where human beings have altered their environment in some way, shape, or way. We put in a bridge, we change the shape of the land, we put in a dam, we put in a building, right? So the structure is a durable change to the environment in which we live, which changes in some way, shape, or form the way we interact with the world around us in ways that we both intend. The building keeps me warm and safe, and in ways we don't necessarily intend. The building prevents me from walking in the way that I used to get to where I like to go. Some structures are created intentionally. Some structures are created accidentally. In other words, think of it like the difference between a sidewalk and a path where everybody just walks the same path over and over. They're both paths. They're both structures, but one was created with an intention and actually achieves a little extra durability because of that intention. The other was created simply through human beings engaging in a pattern-making behavior until it just becomes a fact. And the same is true for some human social structures. Now, when a human social structure is formally created, when we consciously create it, when we create rules for it, when we make rules about how and when it can change, or we say it can't change anymore, when we limit who has access to the structure and under what terms they have access to it, what the structure can and can't do, we call that an institution. So an institution and a structure, they're not real in a physical sense, but they are real enough that they alter the way we behave in a way that is predictable and understandable and comprehensible. So institutions are what our friend Mr. Madison is going to argue are critical to us escaping the worst effects of a faction, is we create through legal means institutions which deal with the effects. Now, what are these? Well, first off, he says we need to create republics. And the reason we create republics is, by their very nature, republics prevent minorities from coming to engage in tyrannical behavior. Now, he's not just talking about any one type of minority. Religious, ideological, philosophical, geographic, demographic, economic, class, it doesn't matter. But a republican system, because it hinges on the idea of majority rule, or at least plurality rule, undermines the ability of minorities to upset the cart, right? But there's a conundrum with this, right? Not all factional systems, not all factional threats to the survival of a free, fair, law-driven, liberty-emphasizing republican system are going to be from the minority. Some of them are going to be majority threats because, again, majorities can behave tyrannically. So how do we do this? How do we manage this? Well, ultimately what we have to do is to create a system in which we have lots of different types of ways in which people are able to attain office. And then we're going to create mechanisms which allow these different offices to check and balance one another. So this is really where we're going to start moving from Federalist number 10 into Federalist number 51. Now, you're like, Dr. Smith, that means there's 41 more Federalist Papers in between. It's worth reading all of them, I'm not going to lie. But we're, you know, unless you want a 25-hour lecture and that'll become the entire basis of the class, we're probably not going to be able to do that. But when we, what we do is we start to say, we look at this, the design of our society, the natural layout of our society, and we can begin to see how factions function. And what we're going to do is design our institutions not only to allow these kind of checks and balances, we're going to get into that a little more, but we're also going to design them specifically with the intention of allowing the maximum number of interest groups to have a role to play in the governance of the state. In other words, the greater the diversity in factions, in interest groups, in parties, whatever you want to call them, the greater the religious diversity, the greater the economic diversity, the greater the ideological diversity, the greater the geographic and demographic diversity, the less prone to breaking down into tyranny a republic is. Now, we actually know this. We've studied regime change quite a bit, and this is something we've actually found to be true. We know that, for instance, states that have only, say, two or three religious groups that are in significant numbers in the state are much more prone to having, for instance, some sort of related civil violence, religious side or a religious takeover of the state or something like that, or just simply the breakout of like religiously identified ethnic warfare or such have you. All of those are much more likely when there are relatively few religions in a state, as opposed to incredibly diverse religious states in which, frankly, such things are very unlikely. And we see this is true for other types of representation as well. So that just leaves us then with our check and balance system. So on that, we go to number 51, and Madison says he's going to insist on a separate and distinct exercise of the different powers of government. So what are those powers of government? Well, we can think of those powers of government as being ultimately the key ways in which governments relate to the law, which of course specifically involves government's ability to and right to use force. So what are those three big ways? All right, the most obvious one is the legislative, right? So the legislative mechanism for dealing with the law is how do we make law? What is the process by which new law will be generated? And secondarily, you would have to assume how we'll remove old law or amend old law. All right, fair enough. Secondly, what do we have? Well, we have the executive function of government. And the executive function of government is one in which we have to sometimes carry out the law. Maybe we're literally defending the state from exterior enemies. Maybe the state is intervening when there are disputes over the law, kind of civil disputes. Maybe the state is engaging in an act of literally capturing and punishing people who violate the law. And of course, the state has a regulatory authority. There are other things the state does, of course, too. It has to get income in order to pay for all these other things, etc. So that's the executive function. So we've got a legislative function, the making of law, and executive function. Super generically, we could just say the carrying out or executing of law. And then we have a third function, the adjudication function or the judicial function. And that's exactly what it sounds like. When there are disputes over the law, when someone is accused of either violating the law or violating a private relationship with someone else, a contract, for instance, then in the United States, just like any other state, the state's function is to basically arbitrate and adjudicate that matter, to come to a decision of who is guilty, to what degree they're guilty, is there a responsibility, what punishments or what, how do we make it right, to put it simply, right? Which can include everything, of course, at the most extreme, from death to paying fines, right? So these are the three essential functions that we find in every single state. They are, in essence, functions, again, that are specifically tied up in specific institutions and that correlate with different relationships with the law. Now, in very, very simple political systems, you could combine these functions into a single person even. You could have a tribe in which, or even a very small kingdom in which you say, well, the king is all of these things. And as long as the king is really good and can keep up with it and very ethical and wise and all that, then that's not necessarily a bad idea. The problem is very quickly that usually turns out to be not true. There's only so much anyone can do in a day. We have, again, as Madison pointed out, the problem that not everyone is actually going to be a good and capable and enlightened leader. And so we reject that pretty instantaneously most of the time. The Greeks will talk about mixed systems, systems in which we try to combine attributes in order to interact with these different functions in different ways and maximize certain benefits. We could get into a lot of detail on that. It's really worth it to study Aristotle in particular. He really, really nails it down. So what then is the solution for us? What is our friend Mr. Madison going to say? Well, what he's going to argue is we should divide up each of the functions into what we today call a branch of government. He actually calls them departments in the Federalist Number 51. And these different branches of government will be independent of each other. Now, not all governments today have fully independent branches. In fact, what we normally call parliamentary systems, the executive function is directly integrated with the legislative function and clearly subservient to it. So this is a choice, which basically means that there's a different understanding of how faction functions and where the threats come from in functions. Specifically, in systems like we have, the fear of regional kinds of tyranny and of the tyranny of the legislature is nearly as high as the fear of tyranny by the executive. In systems in which the executive is subservient to the parliament, we're typically going to see that there was an attitude that the monarch or the executive function was a greater threat than the legislative function and or the threat of localities being tyrannical. So those are some pretty different attitudes. We're not going to touch on it too much. It's more of a comparative politics question, but it's good enough for us to kind of just know about it. So how does Madison, why does he want us to have these distinct and separate ones? Well, first off, he says each of these branches should have a will of their own, and they should be appointed with as little agency as possible from one another. In other words, the legislature should have as little influence on the appointment as the president as possible, or the executive, and the executive and legislature as little as possible over the judicial and vice versa. Ideally, this means, in an ideal world, all of these different functions would be drawn directly from the general population. In other words, we would have elections, or we might have what you might call a demarchy, which is to say randomly chosen people or something like that. But there are problems. And one of the big problems is, especially with the judiciary, is the... I'm so sorry, guys. Is that the judiciary comes with special qualifications and in the English-speaking world at least, a length of tenure that is exceptional, right? Most judges in the English-speaking world serve their entire adult lives. So what does this really mean? What does it come down to? Well, it means that we want to make those independent as possible in order, like understanding that there are limits on this, especially with the judiciary. We want some professional oversight, largely because we're trying to avoid them being influenced by each other in the practice of their day-to-day jobs. We want them to be competing with each other more than they are naturally cooperative. Now, here's the thing. They have to cooperate. In order for competing branches to achieve anything, they're going to have to cooperate. So the natural inclination then is to set them at as much ambivalence and as much, arguably, antagonism as possible in order to encourage that cooperation to lead us to outcomes that are as minimally identifiable with any one group, any one function of government's interests as possible. We also, by the way, want to reiterate this by preventing any emoluments from being based upon each other, or giving them control over each other's emoluments as much as possible. In other words, making sure they don't control how much each one, each other is paid, when they're paid, etc. We want to limit that as much as we can. The goal is ambition must be made to counteract ambition. Now, this is important, guys. This checking and balancing system is going to be, it's going to hinge, if you will, upon a very simple idea. And that simple idea is going to be that we want the different functions to be dominated by different people who achieve their office in different ways. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. And then those different factions that they're a member of, those different interest groups that they're a member of, and their different personal interests, all of them play out so that they are constantly seeking their own interests. They're constantly engaged in their own ambitions. And that results in them preventing each other from achieving their nastier ambitions. Because remember, if the president was to get everything he wanted or she wanted, then Congress will lose all their power. If Congress gets everything they want, the same is true about the president. If the judiciary has the ability to do that, then the same is true for the presidency and the legislature. So what we have is a basic calculus. We want to design a system not based on the ideal way in which human beings would cooperate and achieve outcomes through being best friends and trustworthy, but one which hinges on our own self-interest and selfishness and egoism and our tendency to form into pluralistic factions that don't tend to care about the interests of everyone at the same time. What Madison literally says is, if angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls would be necessary. He's saying that people aren't, in essence, good. We're not monsters, we're not incapable of cooperation, but we have to design our system based upon the thing that we're most certain of. And we're more certain that self-interest governs us on a day-to-day basis than altruism. That's it, that's the fundamental thing. Then we have kind of some, a little bit more reiteration in 51 of kind of what this is going to do, and a huge proportion of the rest of the Federalist Papers talk about this, which is basically like, how are we going to end up doing this? Well, the key is that we make sure the different parts of our political system have the ability to check each other, to force each other to not get everything they want, but to have to conciliate in order to actually achieve things. And so this is particularly notable in the design of the legislature of the United States. Now, the early United States legislature, which is directly influenced by the British legislature of the same time, is not as democratic as the contemporary one, right? We have an upper house, which will name the Senate, and a lower house, which will name the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives, kind of analogous to the House of Commons, the Senate, analogous to the House of Lords in Britain, right? Now, the House of Representatives was elected by people in relatively small districts directly from the various states. So every state is going to be divided after each census into a certain number of districts. The districts are going to be demographically, at least ideally speaking, when there's not gerrymandering, there's going to be demographic internal sensibility to it. In other words, they're going to share a lot of the same interests, religious, ideological, philosophical, economic, social, you name it. And that means that those individuals elected from those districts are going to be very good representations, very good delegates, if you will, of the interests of the people who put them in office. On the other hand, the Senate, well, today the Senate is elected by the entire population of a state. Originally, the Senate was made up of people who were appointed by the state legislatures. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the senators were never intended to represent the particular wills of the people of the state as a whole, so much as the interests of the state government. When the Senate becomes elected, the shift becomes one of the people are of the state as a whole is basically choosing them. So you have actually a similar outcome in practice, but it's a meaningful difference that's not to be sniffed at and made light of. So in essence, though, the states and the elites of the states who dominate those state legislatures, call it frankly what it is, the rich and powerful of those states, are choosing the senators, and the normal schmucks, the normal everyday Joes, are choosing the representatives. So we not only have greater localism and greater kind of non-vocational politics in the House of Representatives, but in the Senate, we're going to have more professionalism. These professionals are going to be specifically more centrist, more moderate, more representative of the general interest of the state, as opposed to the particular interest of any region in the state. And they're going to be really, and of course, then you have the class differences. This has obviously very real implications for the way in which they're going to conceive of the interest of the states, their own personal interests, the interests of their own factional identities, and so forth, right? Okay, very good. What else do we get? Well, we get an executive. Well, our executive was not, like in Britain at the time, a king, but in fact was a different kind of independent executive monarch. We created something called a president. And the president in the United States is going to be elected in a kind of weird way, right? We're going to put it real simple, and we're going to say we have indirect democratic election. In other words, the states decide how they're going to allot their electoral college votes based upon a democratic election in that state. And the states have a lot of leeway in terms of how they could do that. And that allows then the states to basically elect a president influenced by the democracy, but not necessarily directly representative of the democracy. But the president is the only person, and the vice president, who is elected by everyone. So the inclination is, hypothetically, to allow for a greater move towards the middle, towards the center, towards having to balance a majority of factional interests in order to actually put together a coalition to win, to be president, as opposed to you can be elected to the House of Representatives from a very narrow ideological framework, right? And the presidency basically is going to be an office in which this plays out in some interesting ways in the eventual design of the Constitution. Notably, the Electoral College will be designed to allow small states disproportionate influence. So basically, it's going to mean that the larger demographic areas cannot be as dominant as they might otherwise be. This has actually become more of an issue as the size of the population of the United States has grown and has become more concentrated and urban, but the size of the House of Representatives, which has not increased. And since we calculate the total members of the Electoral College based on the total number of members of the House of Representatives, that's why basically the presidential elections have become more prone to elect people who did not win the Democratic vote. So the majority, as it were. And then we have some other kinds of kickers, right? So we have the court system. Court systems are ultimately judges nominated by the president, approved by the Senate, And so you have two different major factional actors involved in the appointment of federal judges, but juries are drawn directly from the people. They're the most democratic part of the American system. So the people directly elect the legislatures that then choose the senators. So you have an indirect influence from that way. They directly elect their representatives to the House of Representatives, and the people serve on juries. So the people are part of this check and balance system as well. They also are indirectly involved in the election of the president. And so through these different mechanisms, directly or indirectly, the people have not insignificant power to remove people from office who fail to represent them in a way that they consider ethical or appropriate. That's the long and the short of it, right? I actually went into a bit more detail drawing from other stuff in the Federalist Papers and basic stuff in American politics. But that's the big and the tall. So, guys, if you have any questions, if you need any help, don't hesitate to email me or call 276-708-6868, and I will help you out on anything. I hope you're doing okay. I hope you're staying safe and well. This is Dr. Smith saying goodbye, and I'll put up another lecture in the next few days. Okay, bye, guys.